From the KBIA newsroom in Columbia, this is Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. I'm Aviv Oakson-Haperman, one of the producers on our show. Today, we're talking about bullying and intimidation, especially the kind that happens online. Let's start by looking at a bill under consideration in our state legislature right now. But first, I want to let you know that we'll be talking about how explicit images are sometimes shared online, and this may not be appropriate for some listeners. In Missouri, you have little legal recourse if you let someone take a sexual or nude picture for their private viewing, and they later share it online. A new bill would change that. The so-called revenge porn bill would make non-consensual dissemination of private sexual images a Class D felony. I spoke with KBIA Capitol reporter Sarah Kellogg about the bill.
So what are some of the arguments that you've heard lawmakers make to advocate for the passage of this bill?
Representative Jim Neely is the sponsor of the bill, and he says he brought it up because while working on a bill on the sexual offender registry with an attorney, the issue was brought up as something that needed to be addressed. Neely, to me, didn't seem like someone who had a very deep background in this. It seemed to him it was brought to his attention that this needed to be passed, so he drafted a bill because of it. But many people who testified on behalf of it, many lauded the bill, saying that it protects those who are victims of the sharing of sexual images. And then the one witness emphasized just how cell phones can be weaponized because currently there's no penalty.
And what are some of the arguments that you've heard people make against this bill?
So there have, from the hearing and just from general, I have not heard any arguments against the bill. Seems like it's a very agreeable bill.
Mm. So previous versions of this bill haven't been passed.
Mm-hmm.
So what are some factors that led to this bill not being passed previously?
Yeah, so I spoke to Representative Neely pretty much right after the hearing. I went up and grabbed him from the House. And what he told me was that the bill was drafted last year. It was the exact same bill, but they simply ran out of time. And so it seemed like there were too many bills, not quite enough time. So that's the main obstacle that stopped it last year. And I think that as long as they have enough time to get through it, I don't see much of a problem of it at least getting to the Senate.
That was KBIA State House reporter Sarah Kellogg. Sarah is following a so-called revenge porn law through the Missouri legislature. Since I spoke with Sarah Kellogg, the House passed the bill and sent it to the Senate. Sandy Davidson says passing the bill would help future victims of revenge porn. Davidson is a professor at the Missouri School of Journalism, where she teaches communications law. She is also the attorney for the Columbia Missourian. In January, she wrote a column in the newspaper calling on Missouri lawmakers to pass a revenge porn law. A reminder here that the topics in the show may not be suitable for some listeners.
Already 38 states and the District of Columbia have passed revenge porn laws. And here's the problem. If you don't have a clear law on the books, then you can have people who engage in revenge porn slipping through the cracks with no good way to prosecute them. So, if it's a criminal law, people have to be put on notice of what is the crime and what is the time. You know, if you can't do the time, you don't do the crime.
Mm-hmm. So how will this affect victims of revenge porn?
It will give prosecutors the opportunity to prosecute the people who have made the victims the victims. Without that, there's no way that a person can be prosecuted. Again, a person has to be put on notice that something is a crime. And if it's not on the books at the time of the activity, there's no way to go back in time after a law has passed.
Mm-hmm.
That would be an ex post facto law. We allow no retroactive application of laws in this state. You know, no ex post facto is just a basic concept of criminal law.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're going to help discourage, you know, deter people from committing revenge porn, we need to get the law on the books now.
We've seen, you know, the creation of social media and more kind of ways to invade someone's privacy. So how has that affected how we talk about privacy law?
Well, what it's done, the Internet, is it's made it so easy to post pictures. pictures of people. The dissemination is so much easier over the internet.
Uh-huh.
So the situation that we're talking about when we're talking about revenge porn is, generally speaking, the man is going to post pictures of the woman. Now, what's happened is this. They've been in an intimate relationship. She consented to his making pictures of her, and then the relationship went south.
Mm.
So in order to shame her, he posts pictures of her in a state of nudity or partial nudity over the internet. The problem is this. The way Missouri's law reads, you've got a violation of privacy law if the picture is made without consent. But under revenge porn law, the recognition is that the picture was made with consent.
Mm-hmm.
However, there was no consent to disseminate that picture.
Mm.
So that's the little glitch that we have right now in the law. If a picture is made with consent, then it falls out of our privacy law.
Well, what would you say to someone who says, you know, the woman or whoever is being photographed knew that they were being photographed and should be more aware of the consequences?
I would say that there's a great distinction between having a picture of yourself made that you think is only going to be shared with someone with whom you have an intimate relationship versus sending that picture out over the internet for everybody to see.
Mm.
The latter is a shaming situation. And consenting for one person to have an image certainly is not the same as consenting to the whole wide world that wants to plug into the internet and see you getting mm-hmm. to do so. That is just such a violation.
Mm. Do you think our laws will ever be able to catch up to the kind of the pace of technology?
Oh, there will always be some lag time. No, you know, there are so many things going on. Legislators have so much to do, and you know, they don't have crystal balls that can predict all of this. So often it does take a bad incident to make lawmakers aware.
Mm.
But when it comes to revenge porn, if you've already got 38 states in the District of Columbia that have made that recognition that there's a problem out there, I would say that legislators are on notice. And, of course, as I mentioned before, we do have legislation pending, and maybe Missouri will pass it this time around.
That was Attorney Sandy Davidson, who teaches communications law at the Missouri School of Journalism. This is Intersection on KBIA. I'm Aviva Kuzin-Haberman, one of the show's producers. Today, we're talking about online bullying and harassment. Now, we're going to pivot from discussing sharing intimate and private images to the other kinds of bullying and online intimidation. Just a heads up, we'll still be talking about some pretty heavy topics, including suicide, in the next interview. While there's still no law against revenge porn in Missouri, lawmakers have addressed cyberbullying. A tragedy sparked that action. More than a decade ago, Megan Meyer died by suicide after she was bullied online. At the time, there was no state law against cyberbullying. That changed in 2008. I spoke with Tina Meyer, Megan's mom. After her daughter's death, she created the Megan Meyer Foundation. She shares her story with students to prevent cyberbullying.
Now, I can tell you before all of this, I would have never wanted to go up and stand in front of a group of students. Mm. You know, I explained to them that I come to them as a mom, that, you know, I am not anything more than coming as a mom, trying to help them maybe think about the way that they interact with somebody, the rumors that they start behind their back, the, you know, shared memes on social media, or excluding somebody out or calling somebody out on Snapchat or Instagram and text chat, how those things that we do can have consequences for good and for bad. And then, you know, the amazing part is, is that you get their attention for a solid hour to an hour and a half. That's the beautiful part about it, is that when we connect with these kids and then we listen to them, listen to their feelings, how they feel, and validate that, not their behaviors or actions, but just value their feelings and talk to them about some, what are some options and what are some things that can work? How do we as adults support you guys?
When someone approaches you after you speak and talks about their kind of personal connection to this topic, maybe they've been affected, what do you tell them?
You know, I just was at a school this week, and I had a student come up. The counselor was actually sitting there talking to me, and the student came up and said that they really connected with the presentation, they appreciate it, and that they have struggled. They've been hospitalized. They struggle with depression and anxiety, and you know, that they really, they've gone through the foster care system and they have gone through a lot of things and get bullied and cyber bullied, and that it's really hurtful and hard, you know. And my job, I always think, is, you know, again, I never pretend to be something I'm not. I never pretend to be a counselor in any way, shape or form. I am a listening ear where I can listen to them and then validate, you know, their feelings of that, you know, thank you for sharing that. And, you know, I'm sorry for what you're going through. That has to be really hard. You know, are you, and then I will be able to talk to them about, you know, so are you continuing to see a counselor? And, you know, how is that going? How, since you've been back and talked to the school, how does the bullying seem to be? Has it changed in any way? And what are some things that I can do for you? What, you know, we can go and sit down and let's talk to the principal about it, or, you know, talk about what are some things that you would like to see happen and how we can do that. And so it's really listening to them, supporting them, but it's always my biggest thing is making sure that when I know that there is been any type of, whether it's self-harm, harm by another, or there is any type of a threat or concern for their safety, it is absolutely essential. I will not leave their side until I make sure that they are with that school counselor, that principal, whoever that leader may be, and then make sure it's relayed to them so that they can get the proper help and do what they need to do. But again, it's being compassionate and listening to them and supporting them and getting them to the right places for help.
What prevention strategies have you found to be the most effective?
When it comes to cyberbullying, we talk about not creating a war of words so that nobody wins. So whenever somebody calls or says something about you, comments on your picture or your post, and you start going back and forth, that they will get other people involved and that no one wins. So we tell them to take a few minutes, take a deep breath. If it's somebody that you know, fine, text them and just say, hey, listen, what was the purpose of that? You know, what was that about? And maybe it was intended in a different way. If it is in a negative way, then you have a right to, we always tell them, take a screenshot, because you want to keep evidence that if this is something that's going to be repeated, that you have proof of the screenshots of showing where it's coming from, the date and the timestamps. And then we tell you to block them. Report it to the internet service providers. And the internet service providers will remove items and will remove content if they say it's violating their terms of service. If it falls under freedom of speech and they're not violating the terms of service, then more than likely they're not going to remove that content. And the other thing is that, you know, we say to let a trusted adult know.
Has it been difficult sharing such a, you know, personal and painful story, you know, over and over again?
You know, I remember in the beginning, there was a woman who came up to me after I did the presentation, and she said, oh, honey, this must be therapeutic for you. good for you. And people are so kind, and people say, try to say the nicest things. But I remember her walking away and thinking, what are you talking about? Do you know my entire insides are shaking every time I talk about it? And no, this isn't therapeutic. I'm doing it because I don't want another parent to stand where I'm standing. I don't want another child to feel that way. But now, years later, it is truly probably how I breathe, how I function. There is no other place I would rather be. There is no other line of work that I would want to do.
That was Tina Meyer. Her daughter Megan died by suicide at the age of 13. She had been bullied online. This is Intersection on KBIA. I'm Aviva Okeson-Haberman, one of the show's producers. Today, we're talking about online bullying. Chad Rose is an expert in preventing bullying. He's a director of the Mizzou Ed Bully Prevention Lab. He works with local schools to prevent bullying through training, intervention, and policy.
If we're working with a kid who has been victimized, one thing that I always tell kids is you're never standing alone. I mean, that's the first thing that all kids need to understand. That's why we have so many problems with some suicidal ideation, is because kids feel like they've exhausted all their resources and they feel like they're standing alone. One thing that we work with our kids on is understanding that they're not standing alone, understanding that they have somebody that they can talk to. And if they don't have somebody they can talk to, we find that person. We work with them on developing a peer base. We know that kids that have one or two good friends are less likely to be victimized. We also work with them on establishing an adult base, to where they know that they can go talk to an adult, whether that's their teacher or their parent or their administrator, whoever that is. We have that planned out to where they know this is what you're going to do if something happens. But also in the long term, kids that experience victimization, we also tend to work with them on critical response skills, learning how to have a conversation, learning how to be assertive and not aggressive, learning how to respond appropriately, learning when it's necessary to go ask for help. All of those things we do, and all of those things we should be doing as adults.
Mm. And so some of your research has focused on kind of the long-term effects of victimization. Mm-hmm. What have you found?
We found that bullying, both kids who engage in bullying and kids who are victimized, there are long-term mental health consequences. We've been able to tie it to depression and anxiety and issues related to self-esteem and also dropout rates and academic achievement. So the outcomes associated with bullying, especially long-term exposure to bullying, is really detrimental.
Mm. What about someone who's a perpetrator?
So kids who engage in bullying behavior, once again, we're going to want to understand the function, like why they're doing that. I've worked with tens of thousands of kids in my career, and I've never met this kid who just wants to bully someone. And so one of the things that we do is work on why they're doing what they're doing, and then establishing a protocol to respond in an appropriate way, but also teaching them new skills. So we have to teach and reinforce new skills that allow them to maintain some level of socialization, but also punish, and I mean punish in the clinical sense, where we're just trying to reduce their challenging behaviors, reduce those challenging behaviors among their peers.
How has the kind of prevalence of social media affected bullying?
Let's say popular culture and mainstream media and social media. Let's just group them all into one.
Okay.
for now.
Uh-huh.
I've been pretty vocal about the fact that we as adults have conditioned kids to engage in bullying behavior.
Huh.
I mean, we put it out there. Like, for example, if you read any children's book out on bullying ever, I can tell you exactly how it goes. The characters are introduced, the bullying's introduced. One of four things happens. Either an adult steps in, peers step up, the victim stands up for him or herself, or the victim runs away. And then what happens is the bullying is resolved. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the book, the last piece of the book is the bully and the victim become best friends. Huh. And that's the message we're sending to kids, especially kids who have been victimized. We're sending a message to say that everybody has to be friends. We're sending a message that says that you're not allowed to be angry about your situation. And we're also sending a message to kids who have been victimized that you need to suppress your thoughts and experiences. Mm-hmm. And what that does is we essentially reinforce these bullying behaviors, yet we're punishing kids who have been victimized. And once again, I mean, purely in the clinical sense of reinforcement and punishment. And so then you have these movies that come out, and movies show, like, for the first 80% of the movie, the victim gets victimized. And then the last 20%, this victim all of a sudden becomes popular and all of a sudden becomes smart or athletic and has all the skills that they need. They have to endure some of this victimization for a long period of time before it gets better. Well, that's definitely not the message that we send to kids. The message that we send to kids is we're going to help it get better, because we don't want kids just to wait. We don't want kids to question, okay, it's bad now, but, like, you know, it's going to get better, but when? So our message is we're going to help it get better. And then with the advent of social media, kids have found an avenue to maintain bullying over a longer period of time. So kids can be victimized 24 hours a day now. Kids can engage in perpetration 24 hours a day now. And it's becoming real problematic. I mean, I get more questions on cyberbullying than I do other forms of bullying, even though our prevalence rates are pretty similar between cyberbullying and physical aggression and relational aggression. Because we just don't know what to do. You know, because kids feel like they have this freedom to say what they want to say on social media platforms. And we're not teaching kids that they don't have the right to make others feel bad about themselves. And there are really very few consequences related to engaging in cyberbullying. And that's become real problematic.
What do you think some of those consequences should be?
Well, I mean, I don't necessarily know consequences per se, but I do know that we need to be monitoring our kids' social media more often. I think parents need to become more involved with monitoring. I think we need to have, if we see kids are engaging in bullying or cyberbullying, they need to have restricted access to their social media accounts. Parents need to be aware of what kids are doing online, and parents and teachers also need to be aware of how kids are interacting, because we live in an environment to where technology continues to evolve. The other things schools need to be doing, and parents, for this matter, should also be teaching some level of online security or cybersecurity, understanding how to interact appropriately. Uh-huh. But I think the biggest consequence now is going to be restricted access to their social media account.
I'm just kind of curious how you got into this field to begin with.
Yeah. As a special education teacher at one of the most diverse secondary schools in the country, and I work primarily with students with emotional behavior disorders. Mm. I work with kids who all had behavior plans, most of which engaged in aggressive or challenging behaviors. And so I went to get my PhD to study violent and aggressive behaviors. I wanted to understand violence. I wanted to understand why kids engaged in aggressive behavior. And I also wanted to understand why teachers interacted with them the way they did. And so what I did was I found that bullying is situated in the middle of violence. Kids who experience victimization over a long period of time have a higher likelihood of responding in an aggressive or violent way. Kids that engage in violent and aggressive behaviors are often labeled as our bullies in schools. So it was a way for me to marry my applied work when I was a teacher to hopefully addressing a larger phenomenon in schools. And now as I move forward, I have a kid of my own, and it has never been more apparent to me that we have to address bullying in our schools. I have a 7-year-old, and I've been on both sides. I remember when my daughter was 3, she came home and she said that she was afraid to go back to school because kids were being mean to her. And so I walked in the school and made it known who I am and what I do and said, look, we're going to change some things around here. And come to find out, the students were, her peers were just walking around acting like dinosaurs, and they were getting a little too close to her. So she wasn't really being bullied. But in that moment, I realized that when parents call schools and when parents speak out, they're speaking out about one of the most important things, or the most important thing in their lives. You know, schools, and I talk to schools about this all the time, schools have to realize that parents aren't calling because they want to be angry. Parents are calling because they're worried about the safety and well-being of the most important thing in their life. And so, and then I had a situation where my daughter was calling another person names for 2 weeks in a row, and I wasn't made aware of it until 2 weeks later. And my daughter and I had a serious conversation. And I mean, I'm having a conversation with a 5-year-old, and I mean, I probably talk to my daughter a lot differently than some parents do. Mm-hmm. But we had a conversation, and one of the things that she said to me at the end of that conversation was, "Okay, Daddy, tomorrow I'll go play with her." And my response to my daughter was, I don't necessarily need you to play with somebody who you don't want to play with. You don't have to be friends with everybody, but you have to be friendly. I mean, you have to be able to associate with people in your peer group, and you know, and you don't have the right to make them feel bad about themselves. And so, but my work has taken on much more meaning as my daughter goes through schools.
Thank you for joining us here on Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. And of course, thank you to our guests, Sarah Kellogg, Sandy Davidson, Tina Meyer, and Chad Rose. If you'd like to listen to the show again, visit us online at kdia.org. You can also like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where we are at IntersectKBIA. Our producers are Sarah Shariari, Abby Ivory Gagne, Elena Rivera, Betsy Smith, and Ahmed Jawadi. Our music is Montana Skies. I'm Aviva Okeson-Haberman for Intersection on KBIA 91.3 FM.
Hi, I'm Sarah Shariari with KBIA. If you or someone you know is dealing with bullying and you don't know where to turn, there are resources out there. One is a website, stopbullying.gov, and another is the Missouri School Violence Hotline. That toll-free number is 1-866-748-7047. I'll be taking a lot of thoughts away from today's show, but I think the one that sticks with me most is that we don't have to be friends with everybody, but we don't have the right to make other people feel bad. That seems like good advice for people of all ages. Thanks for listening to Intersection. We'll see you next week.